I'd like to welcome everyone to session 174, Rereading a New World Scripture, the Reader's Book of Mormon. I don't know if there's supposed to be somebody here to officially do this, but since there isn't, I'll start. As I used to teach my students at UCLA, all reading is, or should be, exercises in how to read better. Hot or noisy? Well, maybe if it quiets down. Okay. Open the back door, that will help. So, the idea of a Reader's Book of Mormon, which, by the way, is available down at the end of this hall. Benchmark's Books is selling them. You get 7 books for the price of 1, which is really unbelievable. This project began a number of years ago in the mind and imagination of our dear friend Eugene England. Gene had been reading the Canon Bible, a Canon Pocket Bible, which is a wonderful collection of books of the Bible introduced, small books like this, introduced by British and American writers. I've been reading them myself lately, and they're really quite wonderful personal views on the scriptures in the Old and the New Testament. So Gene wanted something that was patterned after that, the Canon Bible, and he wanted it written by good writers who had fresh perspectives on different sections of the Book of Mormon. And as you can see, he did a good job of choosing people who could introduce these. I've recently been reading the Canon Bible, as I mentioned, and I brought with me the Canon Pocket Book of Psalms introduced by Bono. And it's really quite a lovely introduction. He starts by saying, "Explaining belief has always been difficult. How do you explain a love and logic at the heart of the universe when the world is so out of whack?" He says, "My religion could not be fiction, but it had to transcend facts." I think it's a wonderful way to think about what we believe. My religion could not be fiction, but it had to transcend facts. It could be mystical, but not mythical. He talks about the influence of the Psalms on his own music writing, and he talks about the 40th Psalm, which became his song 40. 40 became the closing song at U2 shows and on hundreds of occasions, literally hundreds of thousands of people of every size and shape. T-shirts have shouted back the refrain, pinched from Psalm 6, "How long? How long to sing a song?" I have the thought of it as a nagging question, pulling at the hem of an invisible deity whose presence we glimpse only when we act in love. How long hunger? How long hatred? How long until creation grows up and the chaos of its precocious hell-bent adolescence has been discarded? Well, I commend the Canon Bible to your reading, just as I do the Reader's Book of Mormon. So as Gene conceived of this idea, he corresponded with those of us he had asked to write introductions to the 7 sections of the Book of Mormon. And he decided quite early on that he wanted to use the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon for this. He said, "I want modern readers to read the Book of Mormon as the first Mormons read it." Well, we won't be reading that exactly, because they didn't have 7 little books and they didn't have introductions, but the text, which is a pretty clear text, is really refreshing to read because it doesn't have all of the chapter and verse and footnotes and cross references and all of the other paraphernalia that can sometimes get in the way of reading a book. So I wish Gene were here for lots of reasons, but one, so that he could see the completion of his vision, and I think that he would be very pleased with it. He wanted it to be a way that would help modern readers keep reading the Book of Mormon. His instructions to those of us that he chose to read or to write the introductions was, quote, to focus on the literary and religious qualities rather than on matters of historicity or technical theology and doctrine. I expect your introductions will be personal, compelling, even moving, thought-provoking but not argumentative. He said, I've been rereading the Book of Mormon in the original edition over the summer, and it has been enlightening and very moving. Over the course of our long friendship, Gene and I had many discussions about the Book of Mormon. He was open to all of the ideas about it. He was intensely interested in it. His wonderful book collection of personal testimonies, Converted to Christ through the Book of Mormon, remains one of my favorite of his one of my favorites of his many books. He had a keen mind, a searching intellect, and a passion for the Word, both the Word of God and the Word itself as it exists in all of its various forms and formations and fabulations. In a letter to Claudia Bushman, Gene said, I think I understand the book better and am more convinced of two paradoxical things, that it is based on genuine ancient peoples and manuscripts, and that there's lots of Joseph Smith in it. And one marvelous thing, he added, that it is a remarkably important and helpful book spiritually. It was a book that Gene turned to often for consolation and for enlightenment, and I think that he would be pleased to know that the fruition of his project will provide that kind of enlightenment and that kind of consolation to all of those of us who read it in this new edition. Not all of the writers of the introductions of the various sections could be here today. Steve Walker is having a hip replacement or something. Linda Hoffman Kimball could not be here because her husband is ill. She had hoped to be, but couldn't make it, and we miss them. I will try at the end of the other commentators to say something briefly about each of their introductions, which again I commend to your reading. Especially appreciative of Signature Books for designing what I think is a splendid and beautifully packaged collection. The illustrations on the cover, the various covers, are really striking. And I think that the entire production of this book is makes the Book of Mormon, in a new reading and in a new skin, a possible new experience for us. So, what we will do now is have the various writers of the introductions in sequence come up, beginning with Susan Howe, and then followed by Claudia, and then followed by Bert Wilson. And then I will say something about my section, which is the first 18 chapters of Alma. And then Doug Thayer will talk about war and the Book of Mormon. And then I will close with a couple of things from Linda and Stephen's remarks. One of the things that I think is particularly compelling about this is, before Gene passed away, he had asked me to complete this project, and it was for me a labor of love, as anything I did with Gene or for him was a labor of love. And it was sad to me that he was not going to live to finish it. But I think one of the things that was very clear to me as I started reading the essays was how sensitive Gene was to those that he chose to write this. Susan was not among those. He had chosen someone else, but I tried when it came time to find a replacement to do to make a choice that I thought Gene would like, and I'm sure Susan fits that perfectly well. So without further ado, we'll have each of the writers of these introductions talk about the experience of writing and perhaps say something about the section of the Book of Mormon they're introducing.
I'd like to, before I talk about what I wrote, talk about the project itself and how much I enjoyed participating in it and how much I've enjoyed having these little books. The designer, Ron Stuckey, I think he did a wonderful job, and he said he actually measured the size of the book according to having it fit in his pocket. And so, and I love carrying, I'm always carrying around one or another of them, and it's just so handy to have this little book with you. It's easy to read, it's easy to get out and put away. And so just the mere size. The next thing that I've really appreciated in terms of having the books and having the opportunity to read them is the chance to read the 1830s Book of Mormon, which I think is an experience I wish I'd had before, because I think it's significant to look at the book that actually was printed first. And it has taught me, it has made me aware that Joseph Smith really was not an educated person. That subject-verb agreement was not something he did very well. And that there were no editors, and it made it it made the council to, you know, if they are errors, they are the errors of man, and don't think about the things of God. Don't limit yourself from understanding the things of God because of the errors of men. It really emphasized that and made me think about it differently and think about it more. And it also has been a testimony that the spiritual power of the book is in the book, and that the correctives of editing, I mean, I was an editor for several years, so I just go through and I don't actually make the changes on the book, but in my head I do, and so that is something that I do, but the spiritual power of the book is in the book. And it is a pleasure and a difference to read the book in these longer chapters as the book was organized in the 1830s, rather than in the chapter and verses that we have now. The chapters are much longer, there are many fewer of them, and it's like reading a narrative, which changes the experience of reading somewhat. So I've really enjoyed that. I must say I have so much enjoyed reading the other essays. It also alters the experience of reading to be guided into the section by someone else's wise comments about what is going to be coming up in my reading and what I might pay attention to. And I could talk about every individual section, but I don't want, that would be all my time. So, but how that alters your reading experience and expands it, has altered and expanded my reading experience. And another thing that I have been aware of, sort of thematic differences that unify the essays, even though everyone's essay was written individually, not in consultation with other people, and not having talked about what are you going to say, I'm going to say this. And there are some things that come up again and again. One is the mythic elements of the Book of Mormon. Mythic in terms of the book being a guide relevant to the human journey through life, the whole experience of life. That's come up in several of the essays. And how there are portions that these mythic elements take on significance as you apply them to the part of your life that you're journeying through. And how useful it is to think of how the Nephites and the Lamanites conducted their way through their existence compared to how we are conducting our way through our existence. And another thing that I've found as a kind of a thematic concern that comes up again and again is the mourning at the lack of specific detail. How there's this great yearning to have more specificity about the day-to-day lives of the people, their family relationships, what their education was like, how they worshipped, what their homes looked like, and particularly the lack of women's voices and how much richer it would be if the stories of women were included. And Bob Reese even says, maybe that's in the sealed part of the Book of Mormon, and we can hope. And I've thought of that myself. Maybe that's in the sealed part of the Book of Mormon, and someday we can hope to have those stories and have that perspective on experience. Also, Doug said that. My own part is called A Long Consequential Journey. And when I wrote this, I was living in London on BYU Study Abroad, and I was attending a ward that was in the east of London, which is the poor area, indeed the area of Jack the Ripper, called the Whitechapel Ward. And there's another connection with Jean and Charlotte here. They were the first people to go to the Whitechapel Ward. They helped the people in the Whitechapel Ward set up a primary because none of them, all of them were converts, all of them had not been to primary, and they didn't know exactly how to run it. They bought the Whitechapel Ward meets in a school, what we would call an elementary school, in the gymnasium part. That's where the it's very distracting because there are children's posters all around, and they bought a picture of the Savior to display each week. And the people in the Whitechapel Ward are mostly 85% African. And the whole bishopric was African, which I thought was great. And there were only, at the time I wrote this essay, 5 traditional families in the ward. That is consisting of a father, a mother, and children. All the rest of the people were either single women with children or single people. And most of them had emigrated from Africa to London, to England, in the hopes of having a better life. And I really thought about, they had gone on a physical journey that had the kinds of terror and entrance into the unknown that I think Nephi and Lehi and Laman and Lemuel and Sariah and Sam and the families who went with them faced in that wilderness. And so that was an interesting thing to me to think about that journey and how mythic a notion it is to go on a journey, and how there are journeys that we all go on in all our lives. Every time you enter a new phase of your life, it's a new place you've never been before, a metaphoric journey, a new territory that you've never covered, that you've never traversed. And however much experience you bring with you, what happens to you in this new journey will be a surprise. It will not be something that you're prepared for. And there is a difference in the way Nephi and Sariah and Sam make the journey compared to the way Laman and Lemuel make the journey. And one of the things I talk about in my essay is that difference. Laman and Lemuel just don't want to go. And I think that they were spirited away. In the Book of Mormon, it says in one verse they are going, in the next verse, in one sentence they are going, in the next sentence they are in the wilderness. And I think probably Lehi said, we are in danger, we have to leave immediately, get food, get the camels ready or whatever they took with them, get the tents, we have to leave everything, we have to sneak away in the night so that we're not discovered. And so, fearing for their lives, they went, and then only after they got away to a sufficient distance where they felt they wouldn't be discovered and they felt safe, did they start to realize their father meant, this is not just for a while, this is permanent, and he wants us to go to a promised land. In other words, we can never go home. And I think Laman and Lemuel felt not consulted and felt this wasn't their choice, this wasn't their journey, they don't want to go, they don't like it. And they do everything they can then to undermine the journey so they can go home. There really isn't any evidence that the Assyrians are going to descend on Jerusalem and kill most of the people and destroy the city. There is no evidence of that in their lives, and so there is only Lehi's telling them that. And they just want to go home, and they do everything they can along the way to try to get to return home. Where Nephi, he hears what his father says, that his father has received a revelation that they should go, and instead of just dismissing it, he prays. He asks to know what he should do, whether, you know, what this is about, and if it's true that he might have a witness of it too. And he receives a witness that it's true, and because of that, that's my phone. It's a lovely tune. It will stop in a minute. Because he receives a witness, then he makes it his journey. And in making it his own journey, then he does everything he can to help it succeed. And because he does that, he becomes the leader of the group. He becomes the one who is able to accomplish the tasks that need to be done because he's willing to do them. And this sets up the dichotomy then, or the situation in which Laman and Lemuel feel that they are being forced to go by their father and Nephi, that Nephi is trying to exercise authority over them and put his and make them do his will, make them do what he, they actually make him do, that actually happens. And this is a really good lesson, I think, for us, well, for me, particularly at this time, in that, like, right now, my husband has just gone to Germany for 3 months. He's in the Air Guard, he's a chaplain, and he is stationed at Landstuhl Military Hospital, which is where they receive the injured soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. But that means I'm here, and his daughter, who is divorcing, has just moved into our house with her 12-year-old, her 5-year-old, and her 4-month-old baby. And I can either make this situation my journey and make it something that I'm going to be with and participate with and join in so that it might be successful for all of us. Or I can resist it and resent it and wish I didn't have all this extra work to do. And I think that happens often in our lives. This is just something that struck me as sort of a revelatory moment for myself, that I'm in a position of either undermining a journey or helping to make it a successful journey. And I think there are so many of those in our lives. So that's one of the things I wrote about in my section. And I just recommend this highly to you. I wish there could be mass publicity so that people could know they could read the 1830 Book of Mormon. And because the essays have meant so much to me as I've read it. So I'm thrilled to have been able to participate. Thank you.
Well, when Jean invited me to write this essay, my reaction was incredulous resignation. Another thing I was asked to do that I could not do. I don't know anything about the Book of Mormon. I grew up before the days of seminary. I didn't go to Institute or to BYU. I've been through many years of Sunday school classes, but usually with the baby on my lap, in which case you always hear the doctrines through a glass darkly. Meanwhile, I had a resident expert, my husband Richard, who is right there, and I can consult on all spiritual matters and do, so I just don't learn anything. I consult him. So, why am I involved in this project? And the answer to that is because Jean asked me. My best valuable Mormon indoctrination is that when people ask me to do something, I say yes. And when Jean did invite me to do this, to participate, it was perhaps the third time that he had reached in and really changed my life. He's a very influential person, Jean was. I now look at the scriptures differently. When a person has to produce a written piece, he reads things a little differently than he does if he's just skimming them to get through the pages. And I had a wonderful voyage of discovery. And I also want to express my thanks to Bob for carrying on this project, which has been in the works for a very long time. And I have to say, from my experience, that there's not another document in the history of the world that has been as carefully edited as this particular set of books. Every time the new set of corrections came through to me, I said, oh, that's wonderful, you caught things I didn't see, thanks so much, okay, I'm through with this. But then the next week, another version would come back with other things I had skipped and missed. So Bob did really a wonderful job. Now, one of the things I liked about this project was that I saw things differently through the context of time. I could read about Nephi, who was sorrowful about having left his great Middle Eastern experience, although it makes it very poignant to listen to Susan, to how he jumped in and did everything that was required of him, but he felt bad about it. He didn't really particularly want to leave. He was feeling... he was pained to see how barren the culture was that he came to. And it was very clear, as I read, to see how the literary tradition declined in later scribes. Not only the tradition, but the materials necessary to make a record. Well, after I signed on to do the little books, which is what I was going to do, Sheen renegotiated the whole situation and gave me Second Nephi, with its long chunk of barren Isaiah. Well, I was glad to do that, though, because I thought it was a good chance to re-examine those records, that 50 pages that record 25 years of Isaiah. But I'm sorry to say that the beauties of Isaiah, with all their inexplicable grandeur, still elude me. What we have here is the material from the Hebrew Bible in a frame made by the mature Nephi, who has finally separated from his older brothers and their families. He has spent his life in this desolate land, trying to bring his family to repentance, and now, aged and worn, he tries to bring those he hopes are saved, but who are still benighted and primitive, to a knowledge of the great civilization that he knew. That place was dense and rich, but also corrupt. Even his brother Jacob was born too late to know the rich old culture. No children born in the barren, primitive promised land can appreciate it. But Nephi will quote the Baroque Isaiah, and then, in contrast, he will speak plainly about how Israel will be saved. Well, Nephi, having departed from his brothers, rapidly transforms the Lamanites into a forbidden people, the other. Cursed shall be the seed of him that mixeth with their seed. These idle people, full of mischief and subtlety, hunt in the wilderness for beasts of prey. And here comes the cursing, giving the Lamanites a skin of blackness, while the Nephites are white, exceedingly fair and delightsome. This curse divides the good people from the bad, making their difference immediately visible. This is a world of dramatic contrasts, the Nephites versus the Lamanites. The difference in skin colors is just one example of their separation and the distance between them. The good and evil are in constant contrast. We have the hunters versus the shepherds, salvation against the threat of destruction. The opposites are clearly laid out, but the preponderance of examples are negative. The bad people are more bad than the good people are good. Nephi writes in this way, but Isaiah is the king of this divisive style. The choices are exaltation or damnation, with no in-betweens. I have to say that the constant reiteration of Isaiah's demands, on and on, is wearying in the extreme. This is the chloroform in print, spoken of by Mark Twain. This is the boundary at which earnest readers of the Book of Mormon arrive and can get no further. But to me, this is evidence of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, because no one would choose to put in all that endless Isaiah material as a matter of choice. I must say that Isaiah had a very violent imagination. He is relentless in his images of doom. His rhetorical questions, his exclamations, are exhausting. His little stories are scarcely begun before they are abandoned for some other set of images. In these judgments, I realize that I am identifying myself as a member of a barren culture. From Isaiah mostly, we have a long catalog of imaginative ways to blast the sinners, but the scriptures concerning Christ are a very welcome relief. Those of us who like to sing the Messiah find many familiar scriptures here. The librettist made good choices. The message of the Messiah and redemption can be found in Isaiah, but the message is certainly clearer in the writings of Nephi. In chapter 25, Nephi admits that Isaiah spoke many things which were hard for his people to understand, because they are written in the manner of the Jews. He has not taught his people these things because the Jews, according to Nephi, were engaged in works of darkness. But Isaiah is clear to those who are filled with the spirit of prophecy. He likes Isaiah because Nephi is from Jerusalem and saw these things. But Nephi continually asserts that he prophesies plainly. And his wonderful stuff. The Jews had always been warned of their imminent destruction, and Nephi knows that Christ will come, and they will reject him and crucify him, that Jerusalem will be destroyed, and the Jews will be scattered among all nations and scourged until they accept Christ and worship the Father in his name with pure hearts and clean hands and cease to look for another Messiah. Then they will be restored from their lost and fallen state. I find this thrilling, but even more thrilling to me is the next idea. These things which I write shall be kept and preserved, and handed down unto my seed from generation to generation, that the promise may be fulfilled unto Joseph, that his seed should never perish as long as the earth shall stand. This is a powerful message to me, the maintenance and preservation of the record. Nations will be judged according to the written record. Here we have the record testifying of the value of the record. How difficult it is to carry the record on. How important that be done. Then we have an extended case study of the problems of carrying on the record. Jacob, the longest short book, and then Enos, Jerem, Omni, the Words of Mormon. Short books, everyone. I have great sympathy for those who should write more and do not. The years pass quickly in these books. 55 years after settlement, Jacob, the brother of Nephi, born in the wilderness, begins his charge to engrave entries on the small plates. Just 26 pages later, we have traversed more than 400 years. Jacob is told to hand his records down to his seed from generation to generation. At the end of this period, his line has died out, and the records have moved to another lineage. In the first chapter of Jacob, the great Nephi, much beloved of his people, having grown old, dies. His successor as king, not even named, soon grows hard of heart, greedy for riches, lusting after wives and concubines, lifted up in pride. So soon comes the fall from righteousness. So soon comes the break between the administrative and religious leaders. This allows Jacob to speak in a morally superior tone, calling for repentance in an extensive sermon, or maybe even a pamphlet. Most of the book of Jacob is two extended literary pieces, his sermon and the parable of the vineyard. Jacob writes little else. Of his seven chapters, only chapters 1 1/2 of 7 tell a story. The rest is set text, and most of chapter 7 is another little set text, the miraculous conversion of Sherem. Jacob gives us three extended pieces, the last after some years. He does not write much. How could he write this extensive parable when he reports such difficulty in writing? I don't like this business of how hard it is to write and how limited the space is. Why didn't they work out a technology for getting down what they wanted to say instead of complaining about the difficulties? They could have written much more if they left out these tiresome plaints. Jacob's son Enos lived a long life. When he finished his record, it had been 179 years since his young father Jacob had left the old world. But Enos managed to write only 3 pages. Is that enough? He had a powerful conversion experience when he was out hunting beasts in the forest, a wrestle before God. He witnessed wars between the Lamanites and Nephites, and he had preached and declared the word of Christ all my days. He kept the faith. One of his great desires was that his record should be preserved. His constant faith and cries to heaven brought a promise that the records would later come forth, and he was able to rest. But he wrote only 3 pages. These are duly accounted holy scripture. But was there nothing more to say? Should he not have written more? His son Jerem writes even less. Jerem specifically states that he won't write of his prophesying or his revelations because he's writing on the small plates, which were kept to benefit the Lamanites. His fathers have noted all the needs that should be said on the plan of salvation. And he's not alone among those with prophetic gifts. Many others have had revelations. But where are those records? He also notes the skill of the people in working with tools and metals. But he still wrote less than 2 pages. Jerem's son Omni, continuing the record, writes only a couple of paragraphs, confessing himself a man of war and also a wicked man, who did not keep the statutes and commandments of the Lord as he should. His son Amaron reports on the destruction of the wicked Nephites, an act of the Lord to preserve the righteous. Shemesh, continuing the record, wrote a single verse about the succession of the record. Abinadab, his son, talks of the continuing wars and his active sword in two verses. He knows of no revelation worthy of adding. The record-keeping tradition is petering out. Amalekai, a slightly more energetic writer, talks of Mosiah, who fled into the wilderness. Amalekai, and then I'm going to go on to somewhere else. Just a minute now. I think I've got it someplace. But in reading this material, it is clear that technology and tradition are the mothers of literature. For Nephi can write long and extensive repetitious entries full of cautions and punishments because the combination of literary intentions and technology allowed him to write on and on. His successors lack the ability or the will to create an equal record. Bred in the wilderness, they lack the vision of the value of the written record and do a cursory job of carrying on. You can imagine Shemesh and Abinadab knowing that they must enter a few verses and dreading it. Their sketchy entries demonstrate, even more than Nephi's extensive record, the importance of keeping the record. What else was going on? How much has been lost forever? How are trials and accomplishments disappear if no written record remains? How soon all that we know is erased from the earth if we don't write about it? I would rather have a few chapters of minutiae than a long overview of the shifts from prosperity to bondage. How glorious the day when the vaults are open, when we are each given our own Urim and Thummim, and we can repair to the holy library to read the stories of our forefathers. Nephi tells us that the books are there, for I command all men born in the east and in the west and in the north and in the south and in the islands of the sea that they shall write the words which I speak unto them. For out of the books which shall be written, I shall judge the world, every man according to his works, according to that which is written. Meanwhile, of course, the lesson is that we should be writing our own stories.
I'm not going to summarize what I have written in my introduction. I want to do something a little different. I want to tell you why I agreed to write this introduction, to give you the two reasons why I did. To understand the first, you would have to know that Eugene and I, and for me he's always Eugene instead of Gene, we grew up together in Idaho. He didn't become Gene until he was 12 years old and moved to Salt Lake, and people started calling him Gene. There in Idaho, he was always Eugene, and to me, he's remained that as well. But we first met in March of 1939 when my parents moved to Downey, Idaho, and I saw Eugene the last time in August of 2002, when Charlotte and Eugene came over to spend some time with us as we were desperately trying to get packed up to leave the next morning for our public affairs mission in Finland. And I could not, by any stretch of the imagination, imagine at that time that I would not see my good friend again. What I would like to do, and if I do this too long, Bob, go ahead and jank on what shirt tail you can find. But I'd like to just share passages from some of the letters that Eugene wrote to me
after we arrived in Finland. And he wrote them mostly because he had asked me to write one of these sections, and I had told him, no, I'm not a theologian, don't even like theology. Why should I be writing this? And one of the things I've learned all over the years is that it was simply impossible to tell Eugene England no to anything. He ended up getting what he wanted one way or another. But when I left, I hadn't agreed. I told him if I were to write about anything, I'd like to write about Benjamin. And so he said, fine, and put me down for the entire book of Mosiah. But when we left that August day, I hadn't agreed. He assumed I had. And so his first letter was September 11th, 2000. I talked to Gary Bejera, and he agreed with me that it is worth waiting a bit to have you included in our Book of Mormon project. Surely you can find a couple of half days between now and November to do a draft on your section. Please do so. You were my first choice to be included in this adventure, and I still feel that way. There you have in that paragraph the vintage Eugene, confident, commanding, and in full charge of himself. One of the things I would hope you could see from these passages is the echo of true friendship which we had over the years. And I'm embarrassed to read some of these because to try to get me to write, he kept saying all kinds of complimentary things that maybe he believed, but I really don't believe them too much. But he was manipulating me into trying to write. Months later, we no longer have the vintage Eugene, October 21st, 2000. Bert, I'm terribly sorry I've been unresponsive, and especially that I forgot your birthday until I read your journal. I kept a daily journal, and I mailed passages of it by email to Eugene. I've been sick, heart sick, that is, over the situation here at UVSC. I'm working too hard and enjoying it very little. The big symposium we plan to overcome some of the prejudice of the board against us is taking far too much time, and I lie awake at night wondering if it will ever succeed. I asked you, then he talks about other things, and he says, I ask you to please take half a day to do your essay for me. I just can't think of anyone else who would do nearly so well and have convinced Signature Books to put back their deadline to give you time. Remember, I still hadn't said yes. A month later, in November 24th, and you start to see the decline of his health, the self-doubts that enter in about his life and what's happened and going to happen, issues where he was once so sure, he's no longer sure. I confess I've been quite low, thinking too much about my past mistakes and near misses, and wondering if it has all been worthwhile. But when I think of thee, dear friend, my heart soars, and I realize that your regard and confidence in me have made a crucial difference in my life for decades and still do today. My greatest regret is that between us we couldn't find a way to hang on together at BYU and be helpful there to those who might need us. But as you put it, the surrounding worlds have conspired to keep us from fulfilling our dreams. Now I mainly care that we keep our friendship intact and mutually nurturing. I promise to keep trying. Next paragraph. One thing you can do for friendship's sake, if nothing else, is make an attempt at the introductory essay on Mosiah. I think the kind of approach you use to scriptures and writing about your personal response to them is very important to be included. So please, dear friend, take a couple of mornings or whatever and do up a draft in the next week or two. One of the things evident from this is that Eugene thought that everybody else could take a couple of mornings and produce a long manuscript as he could, where it took the rest of us weeks or months to do that. December 5th. I've been thinking about our friendship with great pleasure and gratitude. I miss you very much, especially right now when I'm feeling so low. I still can't figure out what it is. Maybe unresolved depression from my father's death and being released with implied dishonor from BYU. Maybe just plain old burnout. Maybe the lingering effects of my traumatic summer, facing death and the attack from UVSC's board on Mormon studies. At any rate, I feel pretty sad much of the time. Have a hard time getting back my energy and work habits. Even have occasional panic attacks and don't sleep well. But your email cheered me up. You have a wonderfully fresh and clear style with occasional witty linguistic surprises. I wish you had identified those so I'd know what to say really. I wish you'd publish more, which brings me to the Book of Mormon. At any rate, please keep at it and do the essay. I can't imagine the project working well without you. And I would personally be honored to have some of our work together again. By the way, Doug Thayer wrote about Alma and Helaman and certainly undercut the glorification of war. So you'll hear Doug talk about that in a minute. January 18th in 2001. Thank you, dear friend, for your encouraging words, your phone call, your interesting journal entries. I think often of the many good things we have shared and how much I love and admire you. I can think of no one, Bert, whom I trust more and look to for an example of integrity except Charlotte. And I feel I have not lived up to the example of both of you, sometimes by ignoring the counsel of both of you, and I regret that very much. One example of his ignoring the counsel was his essay on why there's no polygamy in the Celestial Kingdom. I think Charlotte and I both stayed up half the night with Eugene and trying to persuade him not to publish that, and he finally agreed not to, and then about 2 months later he published it. If he had something he wanted to say, Charlotte, myself, really nobody else stopped him from doing it. Because in what he was doing, he always wrote because he wanted to help people. And he thought people out there needed that essay. The next letter was in February 11th. I'm doing many careless things like that now, forgetting appointments, losing things, missing details. It's frightening. I just wanted to add that things are still going badly, but I may be making a little progress. I'm sleeping a bit better and getting some writing done. I don't understand what's happening to me. Fear of the unknown. The worst is probably not being able to work with alacrity and confidence as I'm used to doing. Any task is very difficult to face, even normally pleasant ones, like writing, visiting people, preparing my gospel doctrine lesson. I've lost that ability you've commented on of being able to squeeze in my writing between other things. Both the writing and the other things are very hard to do. And yet not doing things is even harder, since there is so much that needs to be done and that I'd like to do. Perhaps if I gradually pull back from almost everything and then reconstruct a life that I entirely choose, I can get it right. I appreciate what you said about BYU. We did indeed fight the good fight and lost. I don't blame myself, but do think of things I could have done differently. At the end of, he writes more, but I won't read it. At the end of the letter, I still hope you can finish that essay, but can't be too pushy since I haven't done my own yet. Please try. Maybe getting yours, the last one, will give me strength and confidence to push ahead. And then on June 24th, he wrote his last letter. He wrote this one by hand. And it's the only one where he doesn't urge me to get on the ball and get that piece written. But I'll read it to you. It was a touching letter for me. Dear Bert and Hannah, to me and my wife, I think of you all of the time and am grateful to God for all the good memories we share. Your letters buoyed me up and filled me with hope and expectation. I've spent many sleepless nights, Bert, like the one you mentioned in your essay. In my case, the uncertainty is simply what we are going to do about my injuries and tumor. We've done all we can do, and it's hard. wearing work, with 25 days of radiation therapy as the final crucial step to see if they got the cancer. Through all my sleepless, lonely nights, thoughts of you come like a sweet melody. I think of the good work you are doing for the church, of your fine family, and what you've done for them, and especially the qualities of integrity and love that shine through in both your lives, from Berg Scholarship to Hanle's community service and lovely friendship with so many. I continue to pray for us. Tell us how you are doing. Any more journal entries would be welcome. I just wish I had a few years without these handicaps to be the kind of constant friend I wish to be. We'll see. Love, Jean. So, the first reason, then, that I finally wrote this essay was that Eugene died. And that was about the only way he could get me to do it, I think. I didn't want to. The friendship he talks about here was genuine and real, and so it was the satisfying of that friendship, my obligation to that friendship, that finally brought me to write the essay. The other reason I wrote it was that I was watching one night on one of the BYU channels. Some of you have probably some of those sessions where they have four people from the religion department talking about the scriptures. It's hard to watch those without going to sleep in the middle of them. But they talked about King Benjamin. And I liked very much what they said in the first part of their presentation that night, where they were talking about the necessity of accepting Christ, of his condescension in coming down and sacrificing himself for us, and how we, through his atonement, can hope to return to his kingdom. But that was just the first half of the sermon. They talked about that, and it was very good. I used part of what they said in my Sunday school lesson the following day. But then they moved into the second part of King Benjamin's sermon, where he talks about our obligation to help the unfortunate, to share of our substance with people who are in need. And they then fell back into that argument I've heard I don't know how many times in church and in other places. Well, we have to take those words with a bit of caution, because if we help people who are suffering and in need, we will destroy their self-reliance. We will make it difficult for them to ever get out of the hole that they're in. There's nothing in King Benjamin's sermon that suggests that. We ought not put in people's words thoughts that they didn't have. I was so angry when I finished listening to them. And surely we ought to be careful when we help people in unfortunate circumstances and do what we can to help them. But King Benjamin didn't set up any qualifiers about when we help and whom we help. If anybody sticks out his hand for help, you help. That's what King Benjamin taught. Now, we will probably want to do that wisely, but to suggest that this passage says what it doesn't say forced me then to pick up my pen and to start to write my section. I want to read just one sentence from the introduction. To make sure his people could not possibly misunderstand that for the atonement to be efficacious in their lives, they must sacrifice themselves to assist others, he added that, this is a quote from King Benjamin, "For the sake of retaining a remission of your sins from day to day, that ye may walk guiltless before God, I would that ye should impart part of your substance to the poor, every man according to that which he hath, such as feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the sick, and administering to their relief, both spiritually and temporally, according to their wants." I'm probably out of time, am I not, Bob?
Yes.
So I'll quit. I was going to mention one metaphor that I used in the essay, but I won't talk about it. So those were the two reasons that I had for writing that. One, to pay tribute to Eugene, to fulfill his wish of for me to honor our friendship, and the second one, to remind myself, and I hope some others, of the obligation we have to help people who are less fortunate than we are. And it's an obligation that can't be dismissed lightly through cavalier comments about self-reliance. Thank you.
Gene England was my friend. I fished with him. Fly fish small streams. When I think of all the men who would like to have come fly fishing with Gene England, I don't know why it was my privilege to do that. One of the most interesting things was when we'd go about every 2 weeks or so, and he'd build up a head of steam about things that he was upset about. And the most interesting part of the trip was traveling down with him because he'd blow a gasket on occasion. It was fun to get the insights. Gene England believed in dialogue. I'm not talking about the journal. I'm talking about discussion between human beings when they have problems that they want to discuss or that they want to solve. And the trouble is that university administrators, and to some extent, be careful about this, I'll just say university administrators do not want any dialogue. They do not want any discussion. It's the last thing they want. They want it in the classroom, but they don't want it in terms of their policies. And Gene ran into that again and again and again. He tried his whole life, his whole professional life certainly, to get that dialogue going so we could solve our problems. If you offended somebody or have been offended, go to that person, discuss it, figure it out. Solve it. That was his philosophy. I don't know for the life of me why Gene asked me to read to do this section. I've had always had an interest in war for some reason. As a boy growing up, I wanted very much to be in the Second World War. I wanted to be a waist gunner or a Spitfire pilot or at least something interesting and heroic. And I was bitterly disappointed that I didn't get that opportunity. Since then, I've become much less enthusiastic about war, but I've been very interested in the sons of Helaman, very interested in Moroni, and in the Lamanites and what they were trying to pull off. But I tend to read the Book of Mormon as a novelist, as a writer of fiction, if having published two novels and having three unpublished novels makes me a novelist. It's amazing how some people can write one unpublished novel and be a novelist. I don't mean to be sarcastic, it just seems to me publish it first and have somebody read it, then you're a novelist. But, for example, I've always been concerned about Laban's head being cut off. I mean, Nephi cuts off his head and puts on his uniform, his clothes, his armor. Well, what about all that blood? Did he wash it off? I mean, it's always kind of bothered me. And Lehi's treasure, he left all that treasure in Jerusalem. He didn't talk about anybody guarding it. They come back, they're going to get the treasure, give it to Laban. And why didn't Laban go and take it? When did he rob the place? The Middle East at that time at least was not, didn't have an adequate police force, as far as I know. But when I read the Book of Mormon, I've got to cut this short. I read it as a novelist. I want to imagine things. And I'm working on a novel now about war, and it interests me that I pulled the sons of Helaman, the stripling warriors, into it on various occasions. This kid who was involved in the Korean War keeps thinking about the sons of Helaman and what they did and what he's doing and how it affected them. He shoots people. He bayonets people in this novel, and I won't tell you the title because I'm not advertising. Oh, I'd like to. And he thinks about the sons of Helaman. They're fighting hand-to-hand. These kids are stripling warriors. They're, as far as I can tell, they're a slight of stature. They're 16, 17, maybe 18. and they're fighting hand-to-hand with swords and spears and bows and arrows and something called a scimitar. I don't know what it is. What do you do? I mean, how do you feel if you're a 16-year-old kid and you plunge a sword into somebody's chest or cut off his arm? And you're wounded, you're bleeding, you're fainting. None of them were killed in battle. I can understand that if they were blessed in that respect. They had no training that's ever indicated. I was in the Army after the Second World War. I was in basic training. It was pretty basic, too, I might add, for a 17-year-old Eagle Scout. fresh out of Utah Valley. I dropped out of high school. One of the smartest things I ever did was drop out of high school and join the Army and go to Germany just after the Second World War. And I think of these kids in terms of my own. I have four sons. They all played football. They have all have knee injuries, slight knee injuries. And I was over, you know, they brought their friends to our house. Somehow we were a place where the kids showed up. The kids came from some of them from wealthy families, and they didn't go to their houses because they were too nice. They came to our house and to our basement. I think I had half the football team sleeping in my basement at one time. Moroni is a very interesting person to me. His strategies, he's upset about stratagems. He uses a spy system, but he's not quite sure it's fair. This amuses me. but he's tough. I mean, if he's willing to give Lamanite prisoners parole, what's called parole, that's called parole in the Civil War, if they would promise not to fight again. If they would not promise, he would either keep them in prison or he would execute them. Bam, that's it. He was very, you know, he was very had a lot of ingenuity, and he created armor. He built, like the Romans, he built these fortifications. You know, the Romans, in some ways, were better engineers than they were. That was one of their great strengths, was their engineering ability, build roads and defensive systems and aqueducts and so on. They tell me that there's a word to decimate, that if a Roman legion or a legion were cowardly, they would line them all up and push over every tenth man. I read that somewhere. I'd like to think it's true. Not because I want, you know, I just think it would be a wonderful thing to be sitting there, standing there, and wondering if you're going to be pushed over. Well, not wonderful, but a little bit, you know, you'd be somewhat concerned. I tell my students that's why they built those high aqueducts, so they'd have a place to push over the legions. But perhaps that's not true. The Lamanites are really stupid, as far as I'm concerned. Moroni keeps foxing him every time. He lures him out of the city and then circles around, takes the city, and waits for him to come back. That happens over and over again. Well, not over and over again, but several times. And they have no organization. They finally wise up and start creating their own armor. But I keep, and T. Ankum, what business has he got going wandering off throwing spears at people? He's a general, you know, you don't do things like that. So when I read the Book of Mormon and I'm finished, probably more ways than one, I read it with this novelist's imagination, and it gets me into all kinds of problems, but it's also a very interesting way to read it, to try to figure it out, to try to understand what's going on. The Book of Mormon is a book about war, as far as I'm concerned, in large measure. It's also one of the most ironic books I've ever read. And I say that to people, and they look at me because you're not supposed to be ironic if you're a member in Full Faith and Fellowship, which I've tried to be. But these people, you know, they're rewarded, they're blessed, so on and so forth, and then they sin. Why would they do that? They're prospering, they've got everything they want, life is wonderful, because they're human beings. One thing I believe in is human nature. I mean, I believe in a lot of things. But I also believe in human nature. Thank you. First reading those letters, that was a wonderful insight into it.
The section of the Book of Mormon that Gene asked me to write about, it was the first 18 chapters of Alma, and essentially Alma the Younger and the Sons of Mosiah's missionary journeys. Gene knew how important missionary work was in my own life. I spent 6 years full-time missionary service for the church, and it's been a very interesting and very rich experience. And as I went back and reread this section of the Book of Mormon, I was reminded of the fact that my family, beginning with my great-great-grandparents, were converted in each generation independent of the previous one on four different generations. So there's been four different generations of my family converted to the gospel independent of the previous one. The Reeses seem particularly hard-headed, I guess, when it comes to those things. The in this section of the Book of Mormon, I was influenced by Claudia's discovery, which is one of the wonderful things about having a feminine perspective, is that she was reading. She said, "I never realized before that Nephi had a pillow." And I'd read that passage lots and lots of times about Nephi watering his pillow by night, but I always thought about Nephi and not the pillow. So it was nice to. So in one of my in part of my book, I talk about the fact that we know so little is the kind of thing that Elizabeth talked about before, and so I talk about the absence of such detail in daily life prevents the Book of Mormon from being a more engaging and compelling narrative. For all we are told about the Nephites and the Lamanites and all the other ites, we know practically nothing of their domestic life. How did they live? What were their routines of their daily lives? How did they educate their children? What of their marriage customs? What sort of songs did they sing? As we look into the distant mirror of their lives, hardly anything concrete is reflected back to us. This reminds me that a generation ago, we knew practically nothing of the Vietnamese, and or we would say today of the Iraqis and the Afghanis. We knew practically nothing of the Vietnamese except that we were killing them in large numbers. Dennis Levertov, in her poem, What Were They Like?, asked this, and this is the kind of question we might ask about the Book of Mormon peoples. Did the people of Vietnam use lanterns of stone? Did they hold ceremonies to reverence the opening of buds? Were they inclined to quiet laughter? Did they use bone and ivory, jade and silver for ornament? Had they an epic poem? Did they distinguish between speech and singing? There is an echo yet of their speech, which was like a song. It was reported their singing resembled the flight of moths in moonlight. Who can say? It is silent now. Well, the Book of Mormon is silent about all of those wonderful details of personal lives that we wish, and someday we may be blessed to understand. What we do have is a book that is remarkable in many ways for many things. The thing about a great work of literature is that it continues to yield its meaning as we approach it, as we come to it. One of the things that might surprise some people is to find the Book of Mormon humorous. In his section on last words of the last words of the Book of Mormon, Stephen Walker writes about finding some of the things humorous. For instance, he said, "I smiled reading about the Jaredites corralling swarms of bees into their boats." Try that sometime. Again, in contemplating Moroni's declaration to write a few more things before he gives us 20 pages of the most densely packed philosophy in all of Scripture. I also like the irony of God's instructions to Jared's brother on the importance of ventilating the boats. Quote, "Behold, thou shalt make a hole in the top thereof, and also in the bottom thereof, and when thou shalt suffer for air, thou shalt unstop the hole thereof and receive air. And if so be that the water come in upon thee, behold," and I'll interrupt here to mention that they would have beheld with particularly rapt attention as the ocean rushed in on them, "behold, you shall stop the hole thereof, that you may not perish in the flood." In other words, Moroni, if the plug lets in the water, consider the possibility you may have opened the wrong end. Well, he talks about the the ending of the Book of Mormon, and he says, even if it were not for this mental comparison of our time, I find the end of the story to be profoundly moving and ineffably sad in its own right. The last words sound as gloomy as taps echoing over a darkened battlefield. Observing the Nephites have fallen to the point that they are without civilization. Moroni bewails the depravity of my people. They are without order and without mercy. These tales of sorrow and death are relentless. In a few short pages, Moroni dies, the Jaredite nation passes away, the Nephite people perish, Moroni himself wanders in elegiac isolation for 20 years and then dies in that final book. Read as literature, these dismal endings come to feel like our own, which is one of the reasons why we read the Book of Mormon, I think, is to understand those parallels to our own. Linda Hoffman Kimball's book, or introduction, which I really encourage you to read, on the on part of Helaman and Third Nephi, talks about the coming of Christ and how her perplexity as a new member of the church when she heard a general authority tell people that they should not no longer have a personal relationship with Jesus, and how baffling that was to her and how bewildering, and how in reading Third Nephi she understood anew that it was possible to have that that personal relationship with Jesus. I've been reading recently in the Book of Mormon, and I've just written an essay called The Children of Light, how the Nephites had two centuries of peace. And as often as I've read that part of the Book of Mormon, I'd never read it until I read it this time, as if I were one of the children who had witnessed that total devastation, that total destruction of all of their civilization. And then in those 3 days of darkness, to not be able to find, not to be able to see any light. We were told that there was no fire, there was no moon, there was no sun. You couldn't strike, you couldn't light a fire, you couldn't see the stars. And so here is a child, and I imagine one of my own grandchildren, 6 or 7 years old, caught in that blackness, that total darkness for 3 days, not being able to find a mother or a father, not being able to find another friend, realizing that probably most of your friends have been killed, and the absolute terror that a child in that situation must have felt, wondering, would there ever come light? There's 3 days of darkness. You don't know that the light will ever come. And then you hear this voice, this small voice speaking, and then a day later you see a personage of light coming, descending. And what that would have done to you as you had been in complete blackness for those 3 nights, completely alone, hearing all of the wailing and the terror around you, the absolute terror in your heart, and then to see a personage of light, and a few days later, to have that personage of light call you and lay his hands on your head, and to have angels come down with fire and circle you. What must it have felt like? And what songs would those people sing? And what weavings would they make? And what dances would they do about this glorious light that came into the darkness? And as I read that, I realized that this book continues to yield these great stories, these great openings into our hearts and minds. And I think that this is what I think Gene had in mind when he started this this project. And so I feel privileged to have been able to complete it and give him all of the credit and honor that is due him for what he did. And as you've heard today from these wonderful introductions, I hope that it stimulates you to get this collection. I figured out there's in the bookstore. It's no longer possible to buy a paperback for $6, and that's what you can get 7 of them for $6 each and buy the whole group. Thank you very much.